Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
This is Auto Line After Hours with Peter DiLorenzo, episode 219 for November 15th, 2013. Luxury Bandwidth.
Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website.
Hey everyone, McElroy here. I'm out traveling, so I can't be on the show tonight. But before you get going, I wanted to remind you to tune in for our special webcast from the LA Auto Show next week. It's brought to you by our signature sponsor, Hyundai, and it will be live on Wednesday, November 20th at 4 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 1 p.m. Pacific. We have a great lineup of guests, including Joe Hinrichs from Ford, Paul Ferrailo, the product planner for BMW North America, and Scott Keogh, who runs Audi of America. Be sure to check out our growing list and submit your questions to us at our website at autoline.tv or use the Twitter hashtag LAASLive. One more time, that live show brought to you by Hyundai starts at 4 p.m. Eastern Time on Wednesday, November 20th, so save the day. And with that, I hand it back over to Peter.
Grazie, Gianni. Welcome, folks. It's another scintillating episode of Autoline After Hours, and we're pleased and proud to be here, as an old ad guy used to tell me. Gary Vasilash, welcome. Automotive Design Production. Mr. Todd Lassa from Automobile. Todd, always a pleasure.
Likewise, Peter.
And Frank Marcus from Motor Trend. Frank, how are you?
I'm just super. Peter, how are you doing?
We're all doing well tonight. And, you know, we have a lot to talk about. We don't have an official guest because, you know, we're pretty happening guys ourselves, so we don't need a guest tonight, right?
Of course. So, you say so.
Yeah. So, one thing, we talked about it earlier. Frank, tell us about Motor Trend's Car of the Year.
Car of the Year, Cadillac CTS. Cadillac's been on the hard climb up to respectability and so forth, and to us, the CTS is like the first car that really goes toe-to-toe with the German competition, the E-Class, the, you know, 5 Series, the A6. It looks the part, the changes they've made, the proportioning, the dash to axle, just the detailing of the exterior, unbelievable. Interior, very upscale. It might be just a shade off of Audi, but probably right in there with, I think, you know, the Mercedes, and better than BMW as far as I'm concerned. Great bandwidth, you know, the 2-liter actually works great. We tried one of those with the all-wheel drive, which you would think would be the worst case. Plenty of power. V6 was actually kind of the least impressive, and the V6 twin turbo, oh my God, you know, they're doing V8 performance, turn twin turbo V8 performance with a twin turbo V6.
So that's 420 horsepower.
Yeah.
It's a fabulous car. It competes with the BMW 550, and of course is lighter. I think they say 400 pounds lighter than the BMW.
Exactly. On the engineering excellence front from Motor Trend's criteria, very high as far as those things go. The Cadillac user interface, not everyone loves it, but I, personally, a lot of us think, hey, that thing is making steps in the right direction. There's a lot of impressive gear in that car.
I actually have to say, I think that's still an Achilles heel, I think. And I can't say, I did the initial drive of the car for Automobile and gave it a pretty glowing review, but we have a long-term, a four-season ATS in our fleet, and I just hate Q. I mean, I cannot get anything between on full blast and off with the fan, with the radio. I mean, it's just really hard.
Develop that sensitive touch.
Dave Leone even gave me some pointers on how to use it, and I tried it afterward, and I think it's, I don't think it's user failure. I think it's software, hardware failure.
And Dave Leone is the chief engineer for that car.
Oh, sorry, yes, exactly.
And we've had Dave on the show not too long ago.
And it gets to the point that you were making about how the OEMs seem so hell-bent on doing things like infotainment systems, including the Q, rather than saying, hey, there are smart guys who know how to do that. Why don't you turn
If I'm making that call to the manufacturer, I'm going to go visit Google or whoever and just say, look, here's a space in our car. We're willing to let you show us your idea for that because we clearly can't really do much with it and see. But that's against everything. That's against the grain of every manufacturer because they want to own it, they want to control it, they want to build it, and they want to make the money from it. Only after the fact they realize, well, if we piss off half of our customers, that's not really very good, is it? So I don't know.
The best systems for the customers going forward will be knobs for the radio and for the HVAC, and you put your own tablet or your own smartphone on the dash, not use.
And speaking of knobs, the new MKC, the Lincoln production vehicle, is going to be shown in LA next week, and it's a real departure on the console, which is it's a beautiful interior, but they went back to knobs. I mean, they clearly are showing us that. You know, especially Ford, you know, they've had their issues, but they're listening, and I think they made the right move. I think eventually I would like to see a manufacturer, you can order, check a box where you have knobs and a radio and then a map that pulls out of the
Doesn't seem like we've had this discussion multiple times.
Yeah.
They've gone away from knobs to buttons and back multiple times. I don't know if people just retire and new guys come in and have that new idea and they have to have it beaten out of them again.
You know, I drove to a local preview of the MKC with one of our young guys, just hired web guys to see the MKC. And he's, 22 or 23 years old, and we had a discussion about that on the way. And he agreed with me. Knobs, buttons are way better than the screen. So it's not an old fart versus young guy sort of thing. That's what everybody
wants. But it was interesting. I was talking to Lisa Drake, who's the chief engineer on MKC yesterday. And, you'd think, a knob is a knob, no big deal. And she said that it is to get the right feel that they wanted for that knob that they're using. So they have a knob for the volume and then for the, selector.
Radio station
selector.
Yeah, right.
And she said it's like an assembly of 10 pieces that they have to put together to make it just right. So, you'd think that basically what they want to do is say, okay, if we can get rid of mechanical things we have to put together and we're able to just do it in software where people get to swipe things and poke things and do whatever, they save dough, right?
And, of course, gesture recognition is the new frontier. And will that be a case where, I can go like this in midair and I've got my virtual knob?
Well, we've been living with gesture recognition since man started driving automobiles when they flipped off the other guy on the road. But, getting back
to Formula One a lot, gesture recognition,
But getting back to Cadillac, they've been on this journey, and when we'll come back to Lincoln, but Cadillac's been on this journey since they introduced the Evoque concept car, which I believe was 99 in Detroit, or 98.
Pebble Beach, actually, before the auto show.
I mean, way back.
Yep.
And, it's a battle, and I'm going to drive the CTS coming up here in a week or so. But everything I've heard is the feel of the car is finally, competitive.
And it's coming at a time when the Germans are starting to lose it and add this, what I call, layer of isolation.
Well, BMW especially, unless you order a 5 Series properly, when you get in it, it doesn't feel like a BMW.
Yeah.
And we've also seen today the new marketing director for Cadillac, who used to work at BMW and
Montblanc.
Is that Montblanc, of all things?
Yeah.
But at least he admitted that. He said that it will take at least 10 years for Cadillac to get to where
another they 10 the, years.
Another
I mean,
10 years on top of.
In Europe.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, but I think to a certain extent in the United States as well.
I think maybe they're closer 10, here.
Maybe not 10 years, but.
I thought those comments were mostly referring to over there.
I think that's what he meant. Yeah.
See, if I was making the call on that, I wouldn't bother with Europe if I was Cadillac at all. I would try to shore up what's going on here and push everything to China. I mean, because that's where the money is.
I think there's a little bit, I think there's a kind of an acknowledgement that for a brand like Cadillac, or for what's supposed to be a global luxury brand, that because of this, because of the internet, that younger buyers, the buyers you want to cultivate and have for the next 10 or 20 or 30 years or more, know all these international brands now.
And they want to buy what's big in Europe.
So Cadillac needs to be an international brand. Lincoln maybe doesn't need to be an international brand. I think despite how much they dispute it, they're taking pretty much a Buick philosophy, or a Buick, following the Buick playbook with China. But Cadillac, I think, needs to be international, including Europe.
But is that just related to automobiles in terms of, I mean, if we think of all consumer products,
oh, sure.
does it matter if, you know, you have a Whirlpool appliance, or does it need to be a Bosch appliance? And does it matter to you whether Whirlpool sells in Germany or not? I mean,
it matters to some people, no question.
But I mean, is there an efficient number of people where you would put all these resources in convincing the Europeans?
But those aren't fashion and lifestyle, you know, purchases, which a car is. You know, you're telling the world something about yourself.
A car is a fashion business.
Well, look, right. And look, Cadillac is never going to win Germany, which is where all the money is and where, you know,
that's what I meant. I didn't mean Cadillac should write off Europe.
Yeah.
But as you mentioned, specifically in Germany, I mean, you know, they're for the home team there.
But if they have a little bit of local presence, if they are, you know, even what Maserati might be in Germany right now, that's more important than just, I think, ignoring it completely and saying, well, just move on to China.
Well, you have to be there, but yeah, good luck with that.
And if the cars are legitimately better, if they're lighter, faster, more efficient, okay, you know, sooner or later, people over there are going to say, you know, if nothing else, it'll drive the Germans in that direction.
Well, but the CTS is the first straight up, you know, give us what you got. We're going to be as good, if not better. So the ATS is pretty good. The CTS, you know, is going to be that car. So
And the thing that's also worth mentioning on CTS is they know they're kind of really in that space now, and they're charging.
Oh, yeah, that's the other thing now.
You're not getting a big discount on a CTS. Like,
you bought $5,000 less than a comparable Mercedes or BMW.
Maybe to start, but when you get them with some stuff, they're pretty close.
The interesting thing, when the ATS push was last year, the ATS and the CTS were right on top of each other, and the CTS fell off the map at the dealer level.
Sure.
Because they had those two cars, and now they've got the strategy, they've got the ATS, they've got the CTS, and they've got the XTS. Now, the XTS is in no way, shape, or form a 7 Series competitor, but the ATS and the CTS are 3 and 5 Series competitors. And it's going to be interesting, but they're asking all the money for the new CTS. And it deserves that money, whether people believe that it should get that money, we'll find out.
And I hope there's not tons of money on the hood right off the bat.
Well,
you know?
And I think that's where the comments about how Cadillac needs 10 years in Europe can apply to the U.S. I think we're still going to see lower ATPs, more discounting on the Cadillac versus a comparable BMW or Mercedes for quite some time. I think it'll be a little while before they can get there and not have to discount the way they have in the past.
See, it'll be interesting to watch the numbers, because let's say you owned a CTS and now you're going into the dealer to buy the new CTS and you see...
It's going to be a 10 grand hit over and above what you remember paying.
Sure. And what is that going to do to the numbers?
We're now paying mid-sized car prices for compact cars. So, I mean, there's a bit of that bump that people should expect. But you're right. I mean, what it comes down to is what's the lease payment going to be, because that's where these cars sell, or where they should be selling, and where Cadillac needs to get into more of a lease buyer, a lease owner program, rather than, you know, to have the same sort of numbers that BMW and Mercedes has in leases, and Audi.
Well, I wish that gentleman luck. I mean, there's some built-in problems that he's going to face, the gentleman from BMW, to be head of Cadillac marketing. One is he's reporting to Amway Bob Ferguson, who was just plucked out of obscurity by Captain Quig, because on a whim, to, hey, you're a smart guy, you run Cadillac. So there's that. And then you have the moribund GM marketing organization, which, you know, a lot of people still there entrenched. So he's got his hands full. Whatever preconceived notions he's bringing, it'll be entirely different, I can assure him. Now, Frank, you're driving an interesting Cadillac.
Yes, the XTS V-Sport, which, you know, that car has been kind of a guilty pleasure. I know as a Motor Trend enthusiast guy, I'm not supposed to like the big, dumb, front-wheel drive-based, you know, placeholder for the 16, you know, or whatever that's coming down the pike. But I liked that car from the first time I looked at it. It's got that big rear overhang that I remember from when I was a kid, you know, the four-hoffa trunk, you know. you know, and now that it's got all this power, you know, it's really nice. And this is a platinum on top of the line, so the interior's got all this lovely wood. And, yeah, I quite like running around in that car.
I had the XTS, not the V-Sport, but I like the car, and I think the interior is really nicely done.
It's very nice.
Very impressive.
Which is important because you have, the car is basically, you know, shares the platform with the Buick LaCrosse now with the Chevy Impala. And, boy, the Impala is right on top of the LaCrosse and not that far down from the, not as far down from the Cadillac as maybe it should be. In fact, I've noticed that with the new, with the update on the LaCrosse, they've added real wood to the dash to have a little bit of a separation from the Chevy. I understand how you feel. It's a nice car to drive. To me, the front drive or all-wheel drive Cadillac is the China car. It's not the car you want to bring into Europe. I don't know if it's a placeholder. I've heard and reported that that they're looking at a next-generation version of the car, and I'm guessing that's largely on the strength of China and here. And maybe, you know, with the standard XTS, some livery sales, too. They've tried to grab some.
It's the outlier, though. It's like Cadillacs are really, they're trying to go in this rear drive dimension that, you know, ATS, CTS, and whatever comes next over there. And this thing is kind of off on an eddy current. But it's cool looking, and So
when you were saying that it reminds you of vehicles of your youth, does it remind you of Cadillacs of your youth?
My youth, they were audacious and in your face, and oh my God, you know, cool, sure. in certain ways. And this one, you know, it has all that look to it, you know.
No, I thought, you know, when I drove that car, my reaction was much like yours. It was like, wow, this is a Cadillac.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And when I was thinking that, I was not thinking about ATS
or
CTS.
Yeah.
I was just thinking of days gone by, and it had the plushness, the comfort, the amenities that one would expect of that car.
That's a good point. I mean, I wrote about this a few weeks ago, and I've hit at it a few times, but it's okay for Cadillac to be Cadillac. I get the, we're going to out-Nürburgring the Germans. I get that positioning. And by the way, I'm thankful Lincoln didn't do that. But, you know, it's okay for Cadillac to be Cadillac. I mean, there's some residual goodness of Cadillac. And in this you know, this hell-bent, we're going to out-Nürburgring the Germans, you know, you get in an XTS and you say, you know, this is pretty cool. It's a pretty nice car.
Well, and to your point, if the CTS V-Sport was a good handling car but didn't have a Cadillac kind of ride to go with it, then it would have been a failure.
Right.
The fact that they could make a car that handles and still rides like a Cadillac makes it a success.
They're getting good bandwidth out of that magnet ride suspension.
Exactly. Yeah. It's really more important for that to be a Cadillac to have a good ride. So I agree with you there. There's no question, you know.
And, you know, back to Lincoln and the MKC. The MKC has a real shot at being successful in the market, I think.
The one thing that impressed me with it is I was impressed with the leather. Believe it or not, it was a soft, buttery kind of leather that you don't expect in what is basically their entry vehicle. It's a C-segment crossover, and very obviously based on the Ford Escape, even though it doesn't look anything like the Ford Escape.
Yeah, no, it doesn't. It's also lower and wider, and the detailing throughout is impressive. And I think they're really going to hit the sweet spot in the market with this car. You know, but Lincoln, you know, it's hard because when you're over there trying to get this brand relaunched, you start saying, well, it's going to take 10 years, and, you know, Everybody.
10 years of not second-guessing yourselves 3 years in.
Yeah. And everybody's already looking at their
clock.
They're
yeah.
already looking at their watches over there.
Plus, what it needs is 10 years and an exclusive car, which they don't have.
They need an exclusive car, and I think they need an exclusive factory. They need to set aside a plant, say, that's where we're going to build Lincolns. You know, maybe they will get.
I think that's pie in the sky.
Yeah, oh, it is pie in the sky.
But what difference does that make? So for that car, for the MKC, so they're going to build it in Louisville, where they're building the Escape. Although, as you point out, it's wider, so you know the track is different. Yeah. But you know they're just expanding the platform. But you know they have an exclusive paint shop for it. They've got technology that's not being used for analyzing the paint in terms of they're going to take a picture of every body panel and compare it to a golden panel to make sure there's no flaws, and they're going to have special inspection.
Yeah, well, what I'm getting at is it's almost as about the internal organization as anything. They have to be consistent. They have to be focused, and they can't waver on the mission for Lincoln. And there's constant people off to the sides throwing in grenades and getting, you know, a little shaky about it, and they've got to stay the course. And if a plant would do that for them internally, maybe, you know, the replacement for the big Lincoln coming, maybe that should have its own plant. I don't know. It's just, it's all part of this image wrangling thing, and the image wrangling is both external and internal in these companies because, let's face it, they're going to need a lot of money to get Lincoln relaunched.
And let's not forget what they're doing, at least in the short term, to try to separate it from Ford, and they're basically taking the Acura playbook. In this case, they're playing up the concierge service. It's all about the service. It's about the experience of owning the vehicle. Well, is there anything special in owning the vehicle? That's the big question. That's the big question they have to answer to sell some of the
vehicles. Yeah, and I'd be careful of that because I wrote about the democratization of luxury this week, which we'll get to. But all of that customer service stuff, that's all going to be the price entry.
Yep.
I mean, I joke about it, but eventually your dealer's going to deliver your newspaper. You know, I mean, it's just, you know, everyone's going to have it.
You don't have anything else to do because you all have ordered it online.
Yeah,
so. Yeah. What newspaper is the other question?
Deliver your newspaper that's on your iPad. Maybe they give you a new iPad every day. I don't know.
Well, and that is a very touchy. I mean, you have to, you're counting on dealers finding people who provide good service.
But, you know, ultimately, where does it come back to? The product.
But, you know, so the question, you know, we were talking about luxury car and what's Cadillac and, you know, that Lincoln wants to regain what it had lost in terms of its level of prestige in the market in terms of being a luxury mark that we recognize. And I mean, the MKC is not going to be available till summer 2014, so they learned the lesson from the launch of the MKZ that this time they're going to make sure it's right, and so it's going to, you know, come out on time. But the thing that I wonder about is, you know, the pricing of that. They pointed out that it is going to be approximately $5,000 less than a Q3 or a Q5 or an X3, and to sort of come out that way. Does that connote luxury to say, well, we've got this one, but it'll be less expensive than our competitors?
Bargain luxury?
Well, maybe they shouldn't talk about price right now.
Yeah, and
they
you
did.
Know,
Farley came out and said it yesterday.
They can charge what those guys are charging when they've earned it, like now CTS has after all these years. They're nowhere near there now. It has to be cheaper.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, what else? Gary, you had something to talk about. Some research that's just been...
Well, yeah, it's sort of interesting. So this consultancy, Booz & Company, does a survey every year of who spends on R&D, and they look at every industry in the world, and it's the Global Innovation 1000. Okay, so, I mean, they're looking far and wide, and so this is every type of industry all around the world. They look everywhere. And, you know, and it gives you a pretty good sense of who the technology leaders are. And, you know... It often strikes me that many people tend to think that the auto industry is a not particularly innovative place, that the auto industry is behind, and the consumer electronics and Apple and Google are the ones who are doing it all. And I found it fascinating. This just came out, and the ranked number one in the world, and this is based on R&D spending, is Volkswagen. Volkswagen spends $11.4 billion.
But they must be R&D. Talking about a percentage. So
the Volkswagen Group.
Yeah, the entire Volkswagen Group. And right. These are raw dollars that they're spending, because if you look at their as a percentage of revenue, they're not number one by any stretch of the imagination. So number two, Samsung, which one would think would be, they're spending more than Volkswagen certainly would. They're at $10.4 billion. So actually, you have a car company that's outspending Samsung, Roche Holdings, a pharmaceutical company, Intel, Microsoft, and then number six is Toyota.
I would rank them by percentage,
yeah.
Though.
What's your total either gross revenue or even, I have to do gross revenue. Because net income is probably still
Tesla's wonderful. Not going to show up on there either, and they're pretty innovative, you know.
Right.
Well, the thing about it is, this goes back to when Washington was taking the auto industry out back to the woodshed, 5 years ago. They had to be reminded that, I hate to say it, but, the auto companies are one of the big parts of the U.S. research ability. Mm-hmm. And they had to, the auto companies had to basically educate Washington in 3 months or less back then. And one of the things they had to be reminded of is there's a lot of research done by the auto companies that people don't know about. And this just happens to,
Sure. So it seems that, the level of technology that permeates everything these guys are doing is going to be, not only are you going to have services being the price of entry, but level of technology being the price of entry. So you talk about the Tesla being an innovative company in terms of the things they're doing, but you wonder, can that scale, can they compete against a Volkswagen or a Toyota or a Daimler or a General Motors in terms of just raw dollars that they're able to give to researchers at universities or at companies to pull this sort of stuff off. So it could be a completely changing environment.
It'd be interesting to break that down too on, how much of that is pure Volkswagen, how much of it is dealing with suppliers. A lot of the tier one suppliers do a lot of the R&D. So do they count Volkswagen buying?
This is their spend.
Uh-huh.
So they spend that. So if they give money to Siemens to do R&D, that would be part of their spend.
Sure. Because Tesla, at least in the public comments, it sounds like Elon Musk wants to do it all himself. When he announced that he was going to have a semi-autonomous car in 2 years, he tweeted for job openings for engineers to make this happen. Whereas, of course, everybody else has been working on it for 20 years or more, and largely in cahoots with the tier one suppliers. So, there's a big difference there, I think, between some of those other companies and the automakers in terms of what they spend on R&D.
Mm-hmm.
So what else were you talking about? So licensed drivers or something?
Oh, yeah. So this is another study. These guys from University of Michigan Transportation Research Institute. I was looking at this. They were looking at a couple of things. When they were looking at the number of miles driven, the number of people driving, and one of the things that they discovered was that they looked at the number of people who are 19 years old who have driver's licenses. And so in 1983, 87.3% of 19-year-olds had driver's licenses. By 2008, that was down to 75.5%. And in 2010, it was 69.5%. So here we have it in 1983, 87%, 2010, 69%. So the question becomes, I mean, is this an ever-diminishing
sort
of a number?
Well, I keep hearing from people that, you know, their kids are just getting their licenses in their 20s because they just didn't need one up until then. They were driven around everywhere, and they, you know, they just never wanted to have one.
I don't understand parents these days, I guess. The only one in my family that has the minute my nephew turned 16, you know, we got him a car. You know, I'm tired of running you everywhere, you know.
Yeah, it's a different.
There might be, I mean, part of it is that supposedly after the Great Recession, we've had the type of families that used to have three or four or five cars, maybe. A couple of them at least were leased, perhaps, now might be back down to two cars or, I don't know, maybe in one car, depending on the location and the economic the resources of the family. But so I wonder if that makes a difference, that you only have two cars per household, and before the kid gets to be 19 years old, he or she doesn't have the opportunity to go out and drive as much.
Well, I keep hearing the financial issue, but I think what this survey is getting at is a fundamental lack of want to.
Yeah. Here.
I mean, you know, it's just a different time. I mean, when we grew up, I mean, I was taking my parents' cars out when I was 14.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you just couldn't wait.
Sure.
There isn't that.
I bought my first car when I was 15, and it was a Mustang, turning 50 this year. Yay.
Well, on that note, we're going to take a little break here, and we're going to hear from our friends at Bridgestone Firestone, and also have some exciting AutoLine promotional materials to distribute.
Introducing a car company that's never made a single car. Legendary durability, impressive mileage, Firestone tires. So unstrap the saddle. These old stallions are ready to run again. Whatever you drive, drive a Firestone.
Whether it's on television, online, or through social media, AutoLine knows how to effectively get your marketing message to the people you want to reach. Contact Stacy Eamon today.
Okay, we're back. We just wanted to remind you that we're giving away, Gary, a black and gray gym/duffel bag.
Wait a minute. That was the one on the bottom.
Wow.
Nice preparation there, Gary.
Yeah, with the new Corvette logo and a dark gray XL t-shirt with the new Corvette logo on the front and a black notebook with new Corvette symbols stamped on the front and back. Now, all you have to do to be eligible is to...
What? Don't we get the poster right here?
Yeah, poster, but there's a bunch of stuff here. All you have to do is to be eligible is be a...
It's not even doing my gestures.
...is a subscriber. You got to be a subscriber to AutoLine's email newsletter. Just sign up on AutoLine.tv by clicking on the daily email link. Now, if you're already a subscriber, congratulations, you're already eligible. We'll be selecting a winner at random from our entire pool of subscribers on Wednesday, November 20th. If you're the winner, we'll contact you and ask for your U.S. mailing address so we can send you the prizes.
Let's just think. There are four things.
We're not eligible, Frank.
Dang.
No, we're not.
We see this stuff all the time.
Okay, another thing that just blew up, but, you know, I was kind of surprised. It was so old news that I didn't understand. I think Reuters just, somebody was clamoring that we got to do something. So they reported yet again that Captain Quigg Ackerson is leaving sometime next year. I've been writing that he's going to be leaving about next May for about 4 months now. But given that Dan's Dan, he just had to respond to an automotive news query, and he said, well, you know, it should be a change agent replacing me, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, it's just like, well, first of all, it's not his call, and he doesn't have the board in his pocket, which, you know, people, none of these articles talk about it because they don't know what's going on the board. He has been personally trying to promote Mary Barra into the job. And it's a not so subtle campaign. And from what I'm understanding, the board has not so subtly pushed back and said, thank you, but, you know, no thanks. So we shall see. But I think Ackerson will leave sometime next late spring. GM will be out of the government will be out of the GM business come, I'm guessing, February at the latest, and that's what's going
to
happen.
So he'll be there long enough to get some sort of new package.
He'll be long enough. There
and
long
already
enough.
Changing his
to get paid.
Stock compensation.
That's all part of the deal. I mean, that's...
Because what we're getting at is that the government, with its partial ownership of GM, set limits on executive compensation. So.
Yeah, and that's hurt the company for sure. They haven't been able to recruit. They've sort of had to pat their top employees on the head and say, keep hanging in there, we'll get out of this. And so.
So who's leading first, Ackerson or Mullally?
Well, I think we'll know that pretty soon.
Oh, the old Microsoft
long shot.
Question,
maybe they'll
right?
do like that.
Yeah. Oh, that'd be fun.
Other news today, one of my favorites, Dario Franchitti, announced his retirement from racing today. He had a horrible wreck at the IndyCar race in Houston about 5 weeks ago, 6 weeks ago, or longer, actually. But in doctor's orders said, you know, he really can't take another hit. Now, Dario had a couple of severe crashes at Michigan International Speedway in IndyCars. He had a bad wreck in NASCAR. He had a motorcycle wreck in his personal time. But, he was very lucky. It was similar. If you're seeing the picture there, when those cars go up in the catch fencing, the driver's helmet, the top of the car is exposed. That's how Dan Walden lost his life. But Dario is one of the classiest individuals to have ever donned a racing suit. He's a wonderful guy and a wonderful ambassador for the sport. And he has a respect for racing history that's unmatched in modern drivers, which is very appreciated because it's nice to see. So wish him the best.
And this is a reminder, Peter, that, you know, just kind of like what we're relearning about the NFL with a lot of injuries lately, that it's still a very dangerous sport. As much as we've gotten used to much safer cars in the last
we have gotten used to it. Of course, NASCAR cars since Dale Earnhardt lost his life at Daytona, you know, they redid the whole NASCAR thing, the Hans device. But, Dario's injuries were such that he can't afford another, I think, with his neck and spine, so.
But when you look at those images, that it's encouraging in some ways that he's able to announce that he's retiring.
Yeah.
I mean, in not that long ago, an accident like that would have been, game over. And
I'm grateful that he's retiring. At 40, won the Indianapolis 500 three times. He wanted to become only the fourth person to win it four times. The other three are A.J. Foyt, Alan Sr., and Rick Mears. Dario won the IndyCar championship. He's a great driver. And I'm glad he's getting to retire at 40. He can live the rest of his life. So what else are we going to talk about today? We've talked about Lincoln. What's bugging you, Todd? I know there's something bugging you tonight.
Something bugging me?
Oh, we were talking about the... we might as well talk about by column, which is the democratization of luxury.
That was a good subject.
Which, what I was trying to get... First of all, we're all familiar, and our viewers out there are familiar with the term democratization of technology, which is the phenomena that's been going on probably forever, but auto companies innovate and introduce their ultimate technologies on their show pony concept cars or on racing cars or on futuristic concept cars. And eventually that technology, you know, filters down to their lesser products. And so what's happening now is this, you know, you're seeing this technology creep down into segments. And the example I gave was direct fuel injection, which was first developed a century ago, but then subsequently came into prominence with the onset of the sophistication of electronics. And now you can get a bunch of four-cylinder engines across the entire industry that have direct fuel injection. So that's a clear-cut example. But what I'm talking about now is the democratization of luxury, and example number one is the new Mercedes-Benz CLA, which comes in at $29,995. And, you know, this car has sparked a lot of discussion. And the point of my column was that Mercedes has to be careful because eventually the image, there's a chance of image degradation going on here, and they are willing to bet that they will overcome any of that. That remains to be seen. You know, CLA is interesting. I mean, you know, you can see why it costs $29,995 if you really look at it.
And really more like $35,000.
But I look back at the C-Class Sport Coupe some years ago, that was a cynical play.
Oh, well, you're talking about the C230 compressor,
that thing,
which I mentioned. That was a
pretty
disaster.
Terrible. Yeah.
It was pretty terrible, and it was a car that was, you know, not unusual for Mercedes-Benz in Europe, where we've talked about the C-Class taxi cabs in Germany. I mean, it's...
I'm concerned if they bring B-Class and A-Class hatchbacky ovoids over here. I think that's probably a bad idea. And okay, fine, electric one, whatever. But this car, I quite like the way it goes down the road. Yeah, the back seat is too small. If it only had two doors, no one would care. They put some doors back there so that the kids can let themselves in and out a little easier. But it is for little kids back there, as far as I'm concerned. I think it's good looking. It reminds me of a GTI, just to drive it around.
Yeah, the thing about it is, I had this conversation with Dieter Zetsche many years ago, and he couldn't understand why the U.S. was so concerned about Mercedes going into lower segments. He said, we have taxi cabs. I said, Dieter, yes. Mercedes in Germany, yeah, they're Mercedes taxi cabs, they're Mercedes trucks, there's Mercedes everything. Over here, you planted your image stake in the ground with engineered like no other car in the world. For a while there, Mercedes was definitely a cut above everything else. And now you're saying, and of course, you know, we saw this degradation going on. They come out with the Maybach.
Yeah.
What's that? Dieter, well, that's the ultimate Mercedes. Wait a minute, I thought you're telling the Mercedes S-Class owner, the guy who just shelled out $130,000 for his S-Class, that, well, no, that's not our ultimate car. This is. I mean, Mercedes has been all over the map. The problem I have with the CLA is, they keep showing us the AMG version, and yeah, that's cool and everything, but, you know, at that price point, even though transaction prices are going to be, I mean, when you get to the dealer, the cars are all like 36, 37, 38,000. First thing it's going to do is it's going to cannibalize C-Class sales. I think it's really going to devastate
this. And push those prices up, too.
Well, yeah, but I think it's going to just cut the legs out of the C-Class. And I think eventually what's happened is, there used to be a distinction for Mercedes, and now they've just announced that they're in the Hyundai-Kia game.
But isn't the fundamental question, what is the bandwidth of luxury?
Well,
okay, and so could they have a B-Class or an A-Class and engineer it like no other vehicle?
Yeah, but see, they've gotten away from engineered like no other vehicle.
And in the automobile industry since Sloan, but separate from what Ford did, has been predicated on the idea that you always want to move up. And to me, what this car really is a competitor. You're going to think I don't know what I'm talking about, but it's a competitor for the Chevrolet Camaro and Ford Mustang. In the late 1990s, that car was the Audi A4. It was the car you would recommend to people who said, oh, I love my Toyota, it's going to run forever, but I've had four of them, I'm bored with them, and I've got a little bit more money, what do I spend it on? You get an Audi A4. When the Chevy Camaro came out, it revitalized the Mustang category, made it a car that you would buy that would be a little bit outside of what you'd normally get from Chevy or Ford. It's not for a family car. The back seat is bad in any of them. But it was something that was a little bit different, a little bit special. It might be the kind of car that would maybe get that 19-year-old to finally get his driver's license. It's that sort of thing. And they're all hovering around $30,000 to $35,000, depending on how you order it, if you get a decent amount of equipment in it. So I think that's what they're trying to do with this car. That's what Audi's going to do with its main competitor, which will be the new A3 sedan coming out soon, and just barely undercutting it in price, I believe. That's what this car is set out to do. Now, whether that's going to do it for more than a year, I think the car is going to probably do pretty well in the U.S. in its first year. After that is the big question. It's like the old coupe.
So do people buy it because it's a luxury car, or do they buy it because it's a Mercedes, or do they buy it because it's a
Mercedes,
or because it's a European car?
No, they're buying it because it's a deal on a Mercedes.
But it's a Mercedes, and outside of the enthusiast crowd, Mercedes is still the brand. It's not BMW. It's not.
Yeah, and it really does look the part. It's not like it's a 40-foot Mercedes. You know, it's got that CLS look to it, which there was a lot of dissension in the Car of the Year ranks, where design is one of our big pillars, and our design experts, you know, like Tom Gale, just hated the back end of that car. So it looked melted in the stove or whatever. I personally kind of like it, and I think a lot of people do like that. You know, that look, that four-door coupe look, it's going on. All the fancy, expensive cars have it. Yeah. So it's a bad play.
Well, the other thing about Mercedes, that the foothold it made in the United States was, as you said, Peter, engineered like a car, like no other car. It was engineering. It wasn't really, if you compared it to luxury car for luxury car to a Cadillac at the time, it was not as plush as a Cadillac. It was better engineered.
Different point of view.
Yeah. And so they may be getting back to the roots a bit. I agree with you to a certain extent, because you now have, you know, Ford and, as I point out, Chevy kind of reaching up into that area. So you've got the entry cars and the luxury cars meeting somewhere at that point, and which one's going to work out better. But the other thing is that they do have engineering built into that car. If you look at the AMG, which is a lot more expensive, of course, it's close to $50,000, but they just announced an EPA highway number of either 30 or 31 for that car, and it's how many horsepower is that, Frank? I don't remember. 200 and...
No, it's 359 or something. It's way up there, yeah. It's the most powerful...
It's 345.
Liter turbo, yeah.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of things going on in this. First of all, Daimler as an entity off to itself in the automotive world is, you know, they are under severe financial pressure. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, they keep putting cars out in multiple segments because they got to move some metal, they got to generate income, because otherwise the alternative is they get bought by somebody. There's a lot going on to this, but we'll be talking about this for a while, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But right now, we're going to go to rapid fire. Okay, here we go. Eric Ambrose asks, is the tool die shortage a big deal? Should I start a high-tech die company?
Sure.
Very.
Good luck hiring the people to work for it.
There's your answer.
That's the tricky part.
You can get a CNC machine, and as long as you know how to program, good to go.
Yeah. Brian asks, the LA Auto Show is next week. Is there any product reveal you are looking forward to seeing? Now, Todd and Frank are going to be in Japan, but
we'll be at the Tokyo show.
Yeah.
Yes.
My first time there in 4 years. Of course, it's held every 2 years, and they're trying to rebuild that show. But there's a number of things at L.A.
The Colorado.
The new Porsche Macan.
Right. Man. And
F-Type coupe?
F-Type coupe. The Lexus coupe.
Yeah, RC?
RC. They're changing the name. They're pulling a BMW on it where it's basically the IS coupe. It's the new IS coupe, but it's separate name, just like 3 Series, 4 Series.
And the Porsche Macan, which will be interesting.
That'll be interesting, yeah.
Dr. Botox asks, is a Hyundai Equus not a luxury car because it is a Hyundai? How much of the luxury perception depends upon heritage? We're going to find that out.
That's a luxury car for sure.
Well, it doesn't, if you buy Lexus Success early on, of course, that has really leveled off in the last few years, but Lexus had a great success from 1990 into the, until a few years ago as a luxury brand with no history whatsoever.
And of course, Genesis is up for big things happening.
And that redo is going to be, that'll really shift.
Gorgeous. And the Fluidic Sculpture 2.0 is.
And of course, Hyundai, went back and forth on whether it wanted to have a separate luxury channel or not and decided not to.
See, wouldn't that be the difference, though? You know, you're talking about the success that Lexus had in terms of being a luxury mark, that they didn't make it a Toyota.
No. Good question. I mean, obviously, Volkswagen in this country had no luck with the Phaeton, but they're still selling those in Germany. It gets back to the old Ford versus GM thing. I mean, if not for... Ford could have easily have gotten rid of Lincoln along with all of its PAG brands. And it's had a history of kind of serving the market from base to fairly nice cars.
Sure.
Mike D. White asks, what does the panel think of Cadillac ELR pricing?
I don't have a problem with it. I think it's fine. It raises the old question of whether General Motors should have started with that car and maybe lost a little bit less per unit than it did on the Chevy Volt. But I think they're going to have some success with that car.
Yeah. Miranda Lynn asks, I realize this is pie in the sky to ask, but is there any way that Chrysler employees or some entity can assist them in freeing them from Fiat? Is there any way that Chrysler could be a standalone company again? Unfortunately not.
Go in the tool and die business.
Yeah.
There you go. And it's making the money for Fiat. Fiat's the anchor in that.
As company. So often happens when someone buys Chrysler.
That's true.
Steve B. asks, why doesn't Chrysler/Fiat make a large SUV based on their Ram trucks and sell it as a Dodge and or Jeep?
Ram Charger.
That's such a small market now, although those vehicles make money hand over fist. Because
72% of the market is owned by General Motors on that one.
Right. Yeah. They make tens of thousands.
And Expedition has most of the rest of it, and then the little Sequoias and things are just nibbling at the edges.
And they still make the Lincoln Navigator. You almost have to remember that, but Lincoln still makes the Navigators.
Did Aspen fit in that space, or is Aspen too small?
Well, Aspen was a little bit of a tweener because it was, Durango was supposedly based off of the Dakota, which was a large mid-sized truck, but it wasn't quite full-size. Yeah.
This one's for you, Gary. G. Jason Anderson asks, I've heard many times on your show how profitable large body-on-frame trucks and SUVs can be for automobile manufacturers, now that we're talking about it. What exactly makes them more profitable? Are the raw materials less expensive, the engineering, development, manufacturing easier, or is the market just such that premium prices can be charged?
D.
No, not really, because now you can charge $25,000 for a pickup truck and make money on it.
Yeah. Right?
No, but people will pay more for a Tahoe, than they will for an Impala,
But Gary, it's more to do the manufacturing of a body on frame is easier than unibody.
Not so much anymore. I mean, because just think about it. I mean, if you look at the number of different types of vehicles that are built as unibody cars. I mean, you have the expertise there now that it blows.
And they're making those bodies that go on those frames almost unibodies anyway.
Right.
Keep them quiet and everything.
Right. And so then the frames today versus the frames 10, 15 years ago. I mean, they're just
hydroformed.
Yeah, so far changed. So there's a lot of money in there. I think what it comes down to is the fact, though, is that there is a greater willingness to pay money for a pickup truck, you know, from the get-go, that you're gonna say, okay, this is gonna cost me more money.
There's a willingness to pay more money for big.
Right.
We're talking about this large SUV market being where all the money is in terms of the markup, in terms of the ATP, and that's shrunk to such a small part of the market. It's still in pickup trucks, and a lot of pickup trucks are sold as fleet vehicles, and those certainly aren't that
expensive. Sure, but the thing you got to think about in terms of the giant SUVs is that when gas prices went up in 2008, 2009, and when the economy crashed in 2008, 2009, then you began to see a precipitous decline in those things.
Oh, yeah, of course.
And then if you look at the pickup truck, similarly, back then, I mean, you look at F-150 sales, I mean, they lost like 25% just like that. That's come back because people need to buy pickup trucks by and large for fleets or because they're small business people or what have you.
Right.
You know.
Right, but my point is those aren't necessarily marked up, and you know, unless you're talking about the King Ranches that get sold to Montana ranchers. I mean, the vast majority are still pickup trucks that go to fleets and to workmen and so on. And
but you could make more money on the big SUV, but there are fewer people that are going to buy them. Therefore, you're going to get the economies of scale from the
pickup. But obviously, they're making money on those less expensive pickup trucks.
Yes.
George from Brooklyn asks, how concerned should Ford be about Lincoln's sales performance? It's too early. I don't think they should be as concerned.
It's the dealers who have to worry.
Yeah, the dealers have to worry right now, but, you know, it's too early to just say, oh, we got to do something else. RTK42C asks, do you have any insight into the upcoming Buick that will be, quote-unquote, much more beautiful Panamera? Is this supposed to be a four-door coupe, maybe a modern Invicta? Wow, yeah, there's a cool name.
Well, that'd be a great name. Of course, the other name.
I thought you wanted the Riviera.
Name floating was Riviera. And supposedly rear-wheel drive on the Omega platform. And to differentiate it from Cadillac, four-door coupe, so-called four-door coupe style to it.
I will complain about Rivieras with more than two doors.
I agree. I mean, I think Buick needs a drop-dead gorgeous design statement two-door coupe Riviera.
Yeah.
But
yeah, not much volume in that. I agree. I mean, Riviera was the name for the two-door hardtops before there was a Riviera, and the Super and Roadmaster Riviera. But you know what? It's better than giving it a three-letter name.
Yeah. Okay. Alexander Karabitsis asks, I saw spy shots of the BMW 4 Series Grand Coupe, and it's really hard to tell the difference between that and the 3 Series. How do you guys think BMW will market the 4 Series Grand Coupe? Is he just talking about the 4 Series Coupe or the...
This is the 3 Series-based version of the... similar to the...
Oh, right.
...ungainly 5 Series Grand Coupe. And I'm trying to remember, you know, it's...
Oh, not the GT. This is like the 6 Series Grand...
I'm sorry.
It's a 3 Series with fatter doors and bigger, wider haunches and a lower roof and more sex appeal that just makes you want to whip out your wallet and pay more money for it.
It's another four-door with a two-door coupe name because of the 4 Series. I'm sorry, I got those mixed up. You're right.
Just the fact we're...
They have one of those, too, a 3 Series.
Just the fact we're talking about, I mean, BMW has just gone off the rails with their segmentation. I mean, it's just ridiculous. They have. They're just, you know...
Well, I just resent that it seems to be taking their eye off the ultimate driving machine idea.
Oh, it is. Which is just... Like I said, you get in a standard 5 Series... And you drive around, and it's just like, what's the deal here?
Yeah.
What's the point?
Well, look, as you all know, they're following, everybody's doing what everybody else is doing. So they have to match Audi and match Mercedes-Benz model for model, basically, and vice versa. You know, each of the three brands are doing that, and that's helping proliferate the lineup.
Does that come from dealers, or does that come from the executives who are sitting there looking at their product lineup?
Gary, you've met German executives.
Ben, let's hear from Youngblood in Cleveland about the Mustang.
Cleveland, Ohio. The December 2013 cover of Car and Driver had the new 2015 Mustang. I'm just wondering if you guys, I like your guys' opinion on it, whether it lives up to all the hoopla that they had before the actual vehicle was leaked.
The actual car, Will, that was not the actual car. That was an artist's rendition. It's wrong in a bunch of areas that the right car improves upon in terms of, I think, all of them. There are things that are ungainly about that car on the cover.
And we have so it's Evos, much more, but, Evos yeah. and Mustang, right? And so let's say that's a continuum. Where is
I don't think
way over here.
There's not
way over Evos.
Yeah, there's very little Evos.
No, I mean you could sort of say maybe the grill shape is a little, but I mean it was always a little that way to begin with. You know?
I think as a car, it's going to be light years better than what we know as a Mustang. So let's hear from the caller in Albany, Ben.
Hi, this is Jeff W. from Albany, New York. About 2 to 3 weeks ago, it was announced in the media that Mark Royce had to, or he voluntarily gave up his Facebook page or whatever in regards to a response that he had, you know, in regards to, you know, some people questioning GM's declining market share, et cetera. I was wondering if there's any more to that story. It didn't really seem like that big of a deal, and didn't understand why it seemed like he kind of made out in the media. It was almost like he was being punished or something. Just wanted the panel's thoughts. Bye.
I don't know if there was any punishment. I dropped off Facebook for a while ago, but I think he had a response to something about declining market share, and it had declined, and it's back up a little bit this year.
Yeah.
It's hovering close to 18%, and this gets back to what GM management said back after the bankruptcy or during the bankruptcy, that the way it was restructured was that they should be able to make money with 18% market share in the U.S. and was it 10 or 12 million? I think it was 12 million annual volume. So now we've got a higher annual volume, and they're just a little bit below 18%.
But on the social media side of this thing, you got to imagine that the PR, you know, powers that be at all the big three really wish everyone would just put their little devices away, because it's just so easy to say something that you regret, you know, in the heat of something. I think, you know, we love when Ralph Gill engages us on Twitter. You know, he says some wonderful things. But
and just like politicians, the executives are so much, you know, they're so much on point and so much, you know, rehearsed in any setting where they speak with us, that to have a little bit of that is really...
It's lovely.
I think it works not just for us, but it should work for the enthusiast, for the people who are interested in where the auto market is going. And especially considering that General Motors has had a very heavy clamp down on leaks in the last few years. We've heard of people getting fired just for saying anything to us. To have a little bit of that looseness goes a long way. Mark Royce is not going to say anything that's going to get him into big trouble.
On that note, it's time to douse the campfire, kids. We've reached the end of the road for tonight's show. I'd like to thank Todd Lasa from Automobile. Todd, where are you on Twitter?
Where am I? I'm on Twitter, am_Lasa, and also occasionally writing commentary blogs at automobilemag.com and, of course, in the magazine.
Yeah, and Frank Marcus?
MT_Marcus. I promise not to blow up your Twitter feed.
And Gary Vasilash from Automotive Design and Production, and they can find you at...
Autofieldguide.com.
Yes. And I'm at autoextremist.com, as you already know. My Twitter account is Peter M. DiLorenzo, instead of Auto Extremist. And you can friend Autoline at facebook.com/AutolineNetwork. And you can follow Autoline on Twitter at twitter.com/Autoline. And we'd like to thank everyone for joining us. John and I will see you next week in L.A. for a special edition of the show. And that's it for tonight.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline this week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.